As you are going to Isaiah chapter 40, we've already had two studies in this chapter. The first one covering just one verse where we saw the command to comfort God's people. Then in the next study of the first, or the next 10 verses taking us up through verse 11, we saw God speak comforting words to the Jews through Isaiah. They were told to prepare their hearts for the coming of God's glory. They were reassured that God himself would reign from Jerusalem. And we talked about how that was a one of the places that you can track down the deity of Jesus Christ. We addressed that Sunday morning as well, the deity of Jesus Christ. Interestingly, after one of those services, after having taught and said, hey, one of the ways to identify a heretic is ask him, is Jesus Christ God? And identified two heretics right in our own midst because they came up yelling at me saying, Jesus is not God. Jesus is not God. So it's a great way to just, shine the light on the darkness. And so encourage you to do that study. I think our Thursday night crowd is Bible students. And so want to encourage you to track that down. God himself will reign from Jerusalem. You can find other places where it clearly shows us that Jesus, the Messiah, will reign from Jerusalem as king. So you can put those things together as Jerusalem points to him and says, here is your God. God reassured them he would be their shepherd. He would gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and would gently lead those that were with young. And so just an awesome time tonight. We pick up in verse 12 and Isaiah begins to remind the Jews and us really about God's greatness and his power. And it's really hard to come up with adjectives as I've gone through this study. I'm running out of adjectives. Unfathomable is a word that I probably will use several times tonight. Incomprehensible is another one as we talk about God's greatness and power. So let's jump in. Verse 12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? So there's a question. Obviously, the answer is God. It's nobody else. No matter where you look in Scripture, there's no two ways about it. You can't avoid seeing this. And what you can't avoid seeing is God is big and God is powerful. And big is too small a word. And powerful is too small a word. So as you look at this, measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. You know, if you stoop down to the stream to get a drink and you try and get water, even if you use two hands, I'll let you use two hands even, and you get maybe half a cup. And then you kind of compare that to the stream that's running by and the stream that's dumping into a river and the river that's dumping into the oceans and the oceans that cover such a huge percentage of the surface of the earth. And you look at this and you say, he could fit all that water in the hollow of his hand. That's a big God. That's a really big God. You can't even really picture how much water is on the earth. I could have looked it up for you in gallons, but it wouldn't have helped you to picture how big God is. He's calculated the dust of the earth by the measure. You know, it's like, again, we're talking about the whole planet. He's marked off the heavens by the span. Remember that a span is half a cubit, and if you remember what a cubit is, it's the distance that a builder would use measuring from his elbow to the tip of his middle finger. That's a cubit. It's about 18 inches. A span is half a cubit, and that's kind of like the hang loose, sign between your thumb and your pinky there. It's 8 or 9 inches, depending on how big or small of a person the man, the builder, tended to be. But if you measure this out and you go, okay, that's exactly half. So a cubit and a span is this distance plus this distance. Well, this is a span. Hang loose, dude. There's a span right there. Okay? I might be able to measure off maybe this stool in spans or this mic stand in a number of spans, a dozen spans or something. God measures off the heavens in spans, in the span of his hand. Scientists tell us that, and astronomers agree that to get to the Andromeda galaxy, traveling at the speed of light. Now, the speed of light, what's the speed of light? 186,000 miles per second? Okay. That's one of those ones I know. I didn't have to put in my notes just to brag about how smart I am. Yeah. 186,000 miles per second. We cannot comprehend that speed. Okay? And so traveling at that speed, getting to the Andromeda galaxy, would take 2.2 million years. So turn on your flashlight and hope that you got energizers in there, you know, because it's going to take a while. And yet God's described as measuring this distance, 2.2 million light years, with spans, you know. Oh, just one, two, three, it's like three spans. That's a big God. That's a big God. And you know, Bible commentators say, well, you know, that's anthropomorphizing. God doesn't really have hands, and God's not really that big. And what do they know? What do they know? If it says God has hands, I think he's got hands. You know, I don't buy into a lot of that kind of stuff. So you can't even begin to comprehend or fathom or whatever word you want to use to really understand how big God is. He's the creator of the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He spoke these things into existence. I don't know how big God is, but if he speaks and creates the universe, if he spoke and create the chair you're sitting on, I'd be impressed. But the entire earth that you're sitting upon is just a very small, you can't even say fraction, because you can't think of a fraction small enough to describe the earth in relation to all of creation. And so in verse 13, who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has informed him, with whom did he consult and who gave him understanding? And who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? Well, now that you have this perspective, kind of as you think about the whole universe, as much as you can possibly wrap your brain around that, and God's measuring that off in spans, like 3.5-4 spans or whatever. As you're picturing this grandiose God now, you've seen these, whether they be commercials or movies or whatever, where it shows the universe and then suddenly everything's getting bigger and bigger and closer, and you're zooming in to you're going towards our solar system, and so you see the planets, and Jupiter whizzes by, and Earth is getting closer and closer and bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally Earth gets so big that it takes up the whole screen, and you see our country, and then you see the lights of cities, and zoom into the city, and it gets down to the city block, and gets down to your house, and zooms into your living room, and you're drinking a Pepsi or whatever the commercial is. So you get this huge perspective, zoom down through that whole thing, kind of do that in your mind and zoom down through the whole thing. And maybe instead of holding a Pepsi, maybe the person is you praying. Wouldn't that be a great thing if you were praying and you're saying, God, here's how this needs to go. And we're guilty of that, aren't we? We're guilty of counseling God. Now, God, I don't really want to tell you how to do your job, but I mean, really, the obvious thing that should happen here. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Well, there's one way you can read that, and you could raise your hand and go, well, I have. Doesn't mean it was right. Doesn't mean he actually took my advice. But I've tried. I've tried to direct the Spirit of the Lord. You zoom out from the universe at large and zoom into our little microscopic cells and wonder why we try to direct the Spirit of the Lord, why we try to be God's counselor and tell him what he should be doing. Well, God, this is unacceptable. You know, this is the plan now, God. Come on, let's have a little confab, just you and me, and let me tell you what the plan's going to be. Has he hired you as his consultant? You know, as God, as it says that, you know, who's taught him? With whom did he consult? Who gave him understanding? We act like this, but it's far from being reality. And remember, you might remember if you were here for our study of the book of Job, you remember that Job thought he had a handle on what was going on, I'd like to have a court in front of God. I'd like God to be the judge, and I could be the defendant, and let me present my case. And, you know, chapter 38 and 39 show up in Job. After a long time, a lot of bad counsel from his friends, and some increasingly presumptuous statements by Job, and God shows up in chapter 38, gets in his face, and starts asking him questions like this. And Job ends up being left speechless. You kind of wish, after reading through Job or sitting through a teacher teaching through Job, that God had shown up in chapter 2 and silenced everybody. But you do get to that point eventually. Verse 15, behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. Well, you've no doubt heard the term, it's a drop in the bucket. And what do people say? How do people use that phrase? That phrase, a drop in a bucket, means something that's so insignificant that it would take millions or billions to make a difference. You know, you talk about the national debt. Let's talk about the national debt of the United States. Well, what do you mean? I paid $6,000 in taxes last year. You know what? That's a drop in the bucket. You know how many times you'd have to come up with $6,000 in order to even make a dent in the national debt? That's what, you know, those kind of terms. It's something so insignificant as to be almost immeasurable. And yet, that phrase came about here. If you look that up in phrase books, the etymology of words and where words and phrases come from, and every book will tell you that here in Isaiah chapter 40, this is where that phrase came from, a drop in the bucket. The nations are like a drop from a bucket. From God's perspective, that's what it is. The nations are like a drop from a bucket. They're regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Now, if you're measuring things, you remember the balances that they would use. You're measuring a couple pounds or something. The dust, even if the whole scale is covered in dust, it makes no difference, right? Now, you like to think otherwise when you're talking about the scales that we use today. The scales we use today are the bathroom scale, right? You get up in the morning and, you know, you're on the diet and you get on the scale. My scale actually goes now down, it's digital, goes down to tenths of a pound. Just to be encouraging. And when it's not encouraging, you know, I'll brush my teeth. I'll figure, you know, the plaque that I've accumulated overnight might get me down another tenth. You know, I'll shave that extra hair. You know, this is where my brain is sometimes in the morning when I first get up. And sometimes it seems to make a difference, you know. So I'll start pulling out teeth just to get that extra tenth of a pound. But at no time have I looked and gone, oh, look, there's dust. This might help. You know, brush the dust off the scale. This might help. This might get me down another couple. No. The nations are like a drop in the bucket. They're like a speck of dust on the scales to God. Now, the nations, we would never think of the nations as being like a drop in the bucket. I mean, after all, the nations are the nations. There's not a whole lot of them, right? We've got the United States. That's a pretty impressive nation. We've got France. That's a nation. I hope the radio ministry goes international someday. The nations are impressive. They're made up of, I mean, usually a lot of nations have people measuring in the millions or even the billions. And you've got nations that have big armies. They have little feeties, short leggies, there's a lot of people and they're powerful, right? They're powerful. And we say, oh, the nations. You wouldn't want a whole nation after you, right? The whole nation of Islam is after me, but that's another teaching for another time. But the nations are impressive. They're powerful. They're you know, what really bases our system of authority. Who's the president if it's not for the nation that he governs? Who are the police if they don't represent the authority of the nation in which we live? They're very powerful. So the nations are huge. From our perspective, wow, you don't get much more powerful than a nation. Unless you become a world dictator over many nations, you just don't get more powerful than the nations. God says the nations, like a drop in the bucket, like a speck on your scale. That is what the nations are to him. There is nothing before him. They're regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. God is huge. God is indescribably powerful. So the nations just really mean nothing to him. We live in constant concern. If you're not concerned about China's financial strength right now, you should be. If you're not concerned about North Korea's nuclear program right now, you should be. If you're not concerned about the Middle Eastern nations' terrorists, then you should be. But God says, that stuff's nothing. It's nothing compared to how great and powerful and big and however you want to describe it, I am. They're nothing. So with that perspective now, read the next few verses, verse 18. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? It's kind of convicting when you think about somebody asks you about, can you describe the Trinity to me? I mean, can you describe to me how there's one God and three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, and you say, God is like an egg. Have you ever heard people say this? God is like an egg. God, you know, the egg is one thing, but it's got a shell, and it's got the yolk, and it's got the white, and they're all the egg. They're all separate, but they're all together, and God is like an egg. Now, theologically, that's a really bad description of the triune nature of God. But just personally, if I was God, I would take offense at it. Ron is like an egg. Okay, and I'm just... a little guy, I'm nothing on the earth. The earth is as nothing to God. God measures the heavens in a span, and people are going, God is like an egg. It's just, when you get that perspective, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, and now this is where God's really directing us. As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. Simon insults it. Anybody get that? No, of course not. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. Okay, so with this perspective now, God directs us to the idea of idols. God is big and powerful. And then he describes idols. And as I was studying this through, I thought of a game that my family plays. It's going to embarrass some members of my family, including myself, but I have no shame, as you've learned in the last 10 years. This game that we play, when we go to a restaurant that has the paper that wraps up the napkin into a circle. We use those. We don't just throw those away, okay? We use these pieces of paper. What we do is that simultaneously all of us will take those little strips of paper and put them under the table. Now, not looking, holding them under the table where we cannot see, and try to tear these pieces of paper to look like a little baby. Okay? So we are making these babies at the restaurant, okay, out of paper. Yes, and yes, my family has made this joke many times. You're not going to be the first. So tearing these pieces of paper and underneath, and the winner of the game is the person who, you know, we all produce then these, well, they're supposed to be babies. Most of them look like E.T. from home, you know. Or they look like a bug, or sometimes, like if you get invited out to dinner with our family, yours will probably be the worst because you don't have any experience at this like we do. So yours will look like a blob. But most of ours, you know, you can detect some feet and arms, and mostly they look like bugs or blobs or you know, some kind of wild beast. And the one who's actually looks like a baby strikingly like a baby, usually mine. No, I'm just kidding. So we have the baby, right? Now we have little babies at the table. But, you know, a year ago, we started having a real baby at the table, my granddaughter. And it's interesting that if you hold these little pieces of paper up next to her, well, number one, she will eat them. But number two, when you compare them, you realize, okay, there is no comparison here. We get a couple chuckles out of the act of doing this, but once people produce the baby, the paper baby, it's like, okay, this is ridiculous. It doesn't look anything like a baby. And certainly when you have a real baby sitting right there, entertaining you, giving you love, responding to you, being the cutest baby in the whole world, then, except for yours, of course, but, you know, it's all perspective, I guess. Then you realize that this is really a poor representation of a baby. So we've got the real baby, and we've got this little piece of paper in shreds. And, you know, for all that we get and interact with my granddaughter, and what happens to the paper babies? Well, they get looked at kind of incredulously by the waitress. What is that? You know, there's a number of them. But essentially, they get thrown away with the used napkins and the chicken bones. So that's our representation made, the works of our hands made to represent the baby when we see the real baby is nothing at all like that. God says, you make an idol to represent me? I measure the heavens in spans, and you make something to represent me? The nations of the world are as nothing to me. They're like a speck of dust on a scale. And you, a person, a created being, try to create something to look like me, to represent me to you? This is by far, of all the places that I've read in Scripture, and I've taught about this before, about the folly of idolatry, this is the one that has clicked with me the most about how offensive idolatry is to God. How incredibly offensive idolatry is to God. That would be like telling my granddaughter that I think this torn piece of paper is a good representation of you. As a matter of fact, rather than talk to you and interact with you, I think I'm going to talk to and interact with this torn napkin ring paper. How offensive is that to God? God wants us to see that idols that man makes to represent him, they're worse than falling short. They're even more than an offense. It's ludicrous. It's beyond stupidity, the idea of idols, whether it's a little Buddha or a crucifix or something, some kind of icon that people bow down before and kiss the toe or whatever it is that people do in churches and other religions. God made man, and now man tries to make God. God made man, and man tries to make God. When man tries to make God, what he does is, he might use gold or silver. Yeah, precious metal, right? It's stuff you dug up from the ground, and you tried to get the dirt out of it. That's going to represent God. Well, you know what? If he's too poor, if he's too impoverished for such an offering, he selects a tree that hopefully won't rot. Hopefully he gets something to make God out of that doesn't have termites or root rot or a poor selection of wood that's not going to last too many years. He tries to get some good wood to make God out of. And of course, you got to find a skillful craftsman. You got to get Norm from the New Yankee Workshop to make you something good. You've got to get Al from Home Improvement. Maybe those two guys are the same. I don't know. But you have to get a skillful craftsman because you know what? When you make God, if you don't make him good enough, he's going to be like a bad table that wobbles. And you don't want your God to wobble or, God forbid, fall over. You wouldn't want your God to fall over now, would you? Can you imagine? Can you imagine how offensive idols are to God? Can you see that? I know for me, I can see that more clearly than I've ever been able to see that before. I've known idols are bad. I know they're wrong. But I think I've got a real good perspective on it, thanks to Isaiah, what he's saying. Saying, this is, you know, a God that wobbles. Maybe you can make a weeble God. He'll wobble, but he won't fall down. A God that wobbles, or a God that falls over, that's a pretty bad characteristic to have for your God. It's pretty bad. I wonder, of all the places that were full of icons and statues of Jesus and Mary and Joseph that were destroyed in floods recently, statues falling over and breaking, things that were worshipped as representative of God that were kissed, fell over and broke. I'm glad my God cannot fall over and break. My God cannot fall over and break. Idols. The stupidity of idolatry is amazing. So from this perspective, hopefully you can understand the offense that God takes to idols. Verse 21 of Isaiah chapter 40. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. It is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them, and they wither. And the storm carries them away like stubble. So, men of influence, their life is but a vapor. Interesting what Isaiah points out here, that he sits above the circle of the earth and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, just little things. But he sits above. Notice Isaiah's perspective. Isaiah is getting a vision from God of God sitting above the circle of the earth. Now, many years before, a lot of years before, God had asked Job, this is Job 38 when God first shows up, verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Job had been talking pretty presumptuously. So go ahead, since you were around when I made this whole thing, tell me who set its measurements? Who was the subcontractor on the dirt work of the earth? Who stretched the line on it? Tell me, what was the name of the guy with the tool belt and the really big Black & Decker measuring tape? Go ahead and tell me that, Job. Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? You know, Job, I must have missed the fact when I was creating the earth and there was an audience, you know, the angels were there and they were shouting for joy. I must have missed you there. You might have been hiding behind Michael and Gabriel's wings or something. Didn't quite see you there, but since you were there, go ahead and tell me some of the details. Prove to me that you were there. Well, what can Job say? He can't say anything. God and the angels were the only ones who saw the origin of the earth's foundations. And when God looked down on his creation, you know what he saw? A circle. A circle. We take that for granted, right? We get pictures from the space shuttle. What do we see? They're circular, right? The circle of the earth, because we have a spherical earth. It's ball-shaped, for those of you not can't talk well. Geometrically accurate. A spherical earth. Man, of course, did not have the benefit of the perspective of looking down upon a circular earth until Yuri Gagarin. Remember the Soviet cosmonaut that went up in space in 1961? Got to look down. See, yep, they were right. It's round. I don't know how there's any atheist astronauts, because I would think that as soon as you get launched up into space with a tin can with a bazillion gallons of rocket fuel behind you, then you better be a praying man, you know. But I bet he was somewhat relieved, you know. Oh, good, the Earth really is spherical. You know, I will be able to orbit and come back down. It's a good thing. Now, of course, we had figured out that the Earth was spherical long before that. We can thank the guys that did geometry and trigonometry and mathematically calculated these things out. And in spite of the Catholic Church's assertions in a flat world, even up until the times of Columbus, we've known that the Earth is spherical for longer than that. A lot of times we kind of have the you know, junior high school history class that says, well, eventually by the, you know, whatever, the 1400s, we figured out that the Earth was round. We knew that before. As a matter of fact, it seems like the Greeks knew it before, but then the Romans forgot it because they decided that the Earth was flat. But there have been people throughout man's history, it seems, that came up with this idea, and it wasn't really universally accepted by everybody till around the days of Columbus. But here's the deal. The oldest book of the Bible, as far as we know, the oldest kept record in history, the book of Job, tells us that long before man ever had an inkling through mathematics that the earth was round, and frankly, you can hardly blame them. Think about it. Think about, hold up a ball, hold up a basketball, and try to tell somebody in ancient Rome, or tell somebody, you know, in the days of Christ even, and say, this is what the earth is, and see, we're like right here. And that explains why we can't see forever. You know, it's everything kind of disappears after a certain point because it's round. Think about how incredulous you would be. You'd be like, oh, so you're saying there are people live on the side? See, you don't understand gravity, and so they would all fall off. Sure, it's a round earth, but we can only really hang out at the top of it anyway. Think about it, if you took too far of a walk, and people aren't on the bottom. Nobody in ancient Israel ever said, stop digging that hole, you're going to dig a hole right to China. Well, number one, that's not mathematically, or it's not geographically correct. It wasn't, maybe, you know, the Native Americans back in the ancient days never told their kids, oh, dig hole to China, you know, they, because there would be no Chinese people, they would all fall off because they didn't understand it. So you can hardly blame early man for not getting the concept of the spherical earth. But God showed, as the creator showed, that long before we even had an inkling that this was the case, showed that he knew that this was a sphere suspended in space, not on the back of a giant tortoise or a flat thing being held up by Atlas. No, that this was a spherical earth in space, suspended on nothing. The oldest book of the Bible, Job chapter 26, verse 7, shows us clearly. He stretches out the north over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. Not the back of a giant turtle, not Atlas, not the ideas that the ancients had. No, this oldest biblical book that we possess says that he hung the earth on nothing. Job 26, verse 7, three verses later. He has inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. Now, at no point would you, without an outside perspective, come to the conclusion, especially as an ancient man, would come up with the idea that there was a boundary between light and darkness, because the sun would set, and of course things go gradually from light to dark. The sun sets, you get sunset, and things, you get twilight, and then finally it's dark. How in the world would anybody know, unless they'd seen from space, the earth and see the line? And you know what? The line that separates light and dark? It's a circle. Think about it. It's a circle. The oldest book of the Bible tells us this. In the Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom says a lot of things. I'll use that term and sound intelligent. anthropomorphizing wisdom. If wisdom could speak, if wisdom were a person, this is what wisdom would say. I was there when God inscribed a circle on the face of the deep. Again, same idea. Jesus showed that he obviously knew the earth was round. In Luke chapter 17, he describes this event that takes place suddenly. It's worldwide, simultaneously all over the earth, and yet he describes things as going on in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening, all, or in the middle of the night, really, all at the same instant. All at the same instant. I tell you, on that night, there will be two men in one bed, one will be taken and the other will be left. Two women grinding at the same place, one will be taken, at the other one will be left. So there are two guys, they're asleep, it's the middle of the night. Again, somewhere else on earth, two women are in the same place, and one's taken, the other's left. But notice, they're doing the afternoon work. They're doing the afternoon work. And then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. The morning work. And it's all happening simultaneously. So it's night, it's afternoon, it's morning, simultaneously on earth. That can only happen on a spherical earth. So anyway, but even here, this is not God's point. This is, the Bible is always accurate in regards to science, but the Bible never claims to be a science book. It's always right when it talks about science, but that's not the point. The point isn't here God saying, ha ha, I know that there's a round earth. The whole point is that he's great, he's powerful, he's sizable, you know, the whole thing. He sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, and he stretches out the heaven. It's describing this. And again, he asks the question after describing his greatness, verse 25, to whom then will you liken me that I would be his equal, says the Holy One. Again, pointing back to the idea of idols. He says, I sit above the earth. You guys are like grasshoppers to me, and yet you presume to make something. You carve something, even if it's life size. What is it, 6 foot tall? You could be like Nebuchadnezzar and make something, what was that, 90 feet tall? Oh, God says, boy, that's impressive. Thanks for representing me with such a big thing. 90 feet tall. Wow, I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. The likeness is incredible. How would you impress God with your image that you would carve of him? Well, I'll tell you what, I met a guy on the street. He had the title deed to Mount Everest. Said for $30,000 I could have it. Well, I went to the bank, got my life savings out, bought Mount Everest, I'll tell you what. He also said if I had any more money, there was this bridge that he wanted to see. So I buy Mount Everest, and you know, I know some friends that they make their living using the chainsaw and the logs, and they make those bears for the tourist places, you know, chainsaw sculpting there, and we're all going to head over to Mount Everest, and I'm going to make God. I'm going to have Mount Everest carved up to look like God. Now, that's going to impress him. Mount Everest? To represent the one who sits above the earth and looks at us like grasshoppers? You could make it look very Mount Rushmore-esque. And we're not going to... Lord, you're not going to be sharing the stage with those dead presidents, you know. Washington, Lincoln, Clinton, whoever's up there, you know. I think that if he bought the mountain, that he wouldn't probably be able to name the four presidents on Mount Rushmore. Be that as it may, you're going to be the only one. We're going to make your face up there real big, God. Is God impressed? Does it match God? God who measures the galaxies, the universe in spans between his thumb and his pinky? I don't think so. Well, what if we bought the whole earth and had that carved up? What if we carved the whole earth to be the shape of God's face? That's certainly got to be big enough to represent him as a proper idol. Not even close. See, God is so powerful. God is so sizable. And let's face it, even if you could make an image as big as God, I don't know how that would be possible. But if you could make an image as big as God, still just an image. It's still a piece of paper next to the baby. That's all it is. So, again, to whom then will you liken me that I would be its equal, says the Holy One, or his equal? That word's implied. He actually said that I would be equal. What are you going to liken me to that I'll be equal to it? It just falls woefully short. Verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and see see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. God has created the stars. He's created them. He knows them. He's familiar with every one of them. They're all a work of art, every single one of them. You know, the nearest star to us is the sun. Not everybody knows that. As a matter of fact, this story enough is reason why radio is never going to go national here. Mr. Gonzalez was my jazz band teacher. He was also the remedial ninth grade science teacher. Now, by remedial, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about his class. But at jazz band, it was after lunch. I think it was fifth or sixth period. He had prepared a science test. And so we were all hanging out by his keyboard. He had this cool keyboard that he'd play. And we saw this test. And the test said, the biggest planet in the solar system is, and then it listed Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, Mercury, you know, like five things or whatever. And we saw his answer key was incorrect. And we said, hey, Gonzo, that's jazz, you know. So, hey, Gonzo, this answer key's wrong. You know, it's Jupiter. And he goes, no, man, it's the sun. This is the science teacher. The biggest planet in our solar system is the sun. Wow. So the kids were as remedial at the end of the year as they were in the beginning of the year, I'm pretty sure. Again, hopefully this never gets aired. But so we know that the sun is a star. It's the closest star to us. It takes about 8-point-something minutes for the light of the sun to get to us, so it's still quite a distance away. As a matter of fact, if you wanted to drive there and you only had a gallon of gas, you'd need to get a car that had 93 million miles per gallon. Okay, it's 93 million miles away. We can't even think that much. You can't even comprehend what 93 million miles is, but that's how far away the nearest star. The nearest star to the sun, we used to say was Alpha Centauri, but it turned out that Alpha Centauri is actually three stars together. The two of them we see, they're so close together you can't really tell with the naked eye, but the one that's closest to us is actually quite a bit dimmer, but we apparently know it's there. The name of that, in case you ever want to go there on your next vacation, Proxima Centauri. It's, now get this, if you're writing this down, this is a lot of zeros, 25 million miles from the sun. It's not just 25 million miles, it's 25 million million miles. So go a million miles and then do that again 24 million times, going a million miles. So it's pretty far. In 2003, latest data I could come up with, it was estimated that the number of stars that we can see from Earth, using telescopes and everything, not just with the naked eye, but the number of stars that we can see from Earth, we can see 70,000 million, million, million stars. That's 3 million. 70,000 million, million, million. That's like when you start making up numbers. It's like a jagillion, you know. If you're trying to compare that, that's 10 times as many stars as there are grains of sand on every beach and desert on the Earth. Can you imagine the job of astronomers? All right, it's your turn to start cataloging them. Start numbering them. just the ones you can see. See, we can only see 70,000 million stars. And we haven't even come close to naming them. As a matter of fact, it's my understanding that some of these internet outfits, you can send away $30 or $100 and have one of them named after you. It's the only way I'm going to get my star. We haven't even named them all. We certainly haven't seen them all. And yet God has names for all of them. He hasn't lost one of them. He can see all of them. Look at the stars he's created. He leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name. Why? Because of the greatness of his might and his strength and his power. Not one of them is missing. We haven't even seen them all. He's named them all. He leads them all. He hasn't missed any of them. So then the question remains, if God can see all this and keep track of all this, what makes us think that we can hide our sin from him? See, that it's great when we say, God is so big. Huh, idols, that's dumb. But we say, God is so big, and I try to hide my sin from him. Why do you say, O Jacob, and this is verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. God, are you waiting for God to get sleepy? Do you wait for night to sin? You behave yourself during the day, but at night when God's asleep, is that when you sin? Or you go to dark places. You know, you don't have to wait till night to go to a dark place. It's my understanding that most bar owners have figured out that the darker the place, the better the business. You ever notice that? It is a trick question. Shame on you if you've ever noticed that. The bars and the nightclubs, the darker it is, the better it is, the better the business is. Why is that? Why do crime rates increase so exponentially at night? Now, not just in the middle of the night when you'd expect, hey, people are sleeping, I'll break into their house. It seems like as soon as the sun sets, the 911 calls increase radically. Why is this? Is it because just simply we say, oh, you know, dark, it's easier to want to sin? Or do people subconsciously, or maybe even consciously, think that God can't see in the dark? Or that maybe he's asleep? You know, God doesn't get tired, and God never gets distracted. Hey, God, look over there, you know, and try and get away with something. It's like these bank robbers that get in small towns, you know, and they have one crime committed or they make 911 calls. On one side of town, there's only three cops on duty. All three cops rush over there. They rob the bank on the other side of town. Now, I really hope we don't get on the radio with this because people go, really? That work? Oh, I'll have to try that. So, does God sleep? Of course not. Not like the other gods, the quote-unquote gods that people worship. One of my favorite stories in the Bible, the little histories, the scenes, is when Elijah is on Mount Carmel and he's going to go to battle with the priests of Baal. All these priests of the false god Baal. And he has this showdown on Mount Carmel. You can read about this in 1 Kings 18. As a matter of fact, I can read this to you. Elijah says, okay, so let's get two oxen. Let them, the priests, choose one of the oxen for themselves. They cut it up, put it on the wood. No fire, though. Set it up like an altar, but don't light it on fire. And I won't put a fire under it. Then they can call on the name of their God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, that's God. So it's a God showdown. We've got Baal the God and Yahweh the God. And we'll just, two altars set up. We say, Baal, if you're real, just send fire from heaven and whoosh, consume that thing. And Yahweh, God, the Lord of the Jews, if you're real, send fire down and whoosh, consume that thing. So there you go. It's a God showdown. It's a God competition. So all the people said, that's a good idea. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one ox for yourself, prepare it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God. but put no fire under it. So he says, there's a lot of you. This won't take long, so you guys go ahead and go first. So they took the ox that was given them. They prepared it. They called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. 6 hours. Oh, Baal, answer us. Oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about on the altar which they made. Came about at noon. I love this. This is at this point, this is why it becomes my favorite story. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a louder voice. Well, for he is a god. Either he's occupied or gone aside. That's proper translation for he's in the potty room. Or he's on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened, so shout louder. So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves, according to their custom, with swords and lances until the blood gushed out on them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. Maybe your God's busy, Elijah said. Maybe he's in the bathroom. Maybe he's on vacation. Or maybe he's asleep. I just realized, looking at my notes, that I didn't really think to finish this story. I was just going to leave it there. If you don't know the end of this history, basically Elijah says, hey, God, show him your stuff. And fire from heaven, you know. He didn't have to dance around or do anything. Certainly didn't have to cut himself. Why is that? Well, because God is never asleep. God's never asleep. He's never distracted. Our way is never hidden from him, no matter how dark our surroundings might be. As a matter of fact, remember, it got to be evening time, and Baal still hadn't answered, so now it's nighttime. That must have been even more impressive. Fire coming down from heaven in the nighttime. So, verse 29. I like this because, notice this, he doesn't become weary or tired. Verse 29, he doesn't become weary or tired, but he knows that we do. Because he says, he gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. God is all powerful, and yet he realizes that our power is frequently drained. Though youths even grow weary and tired. I saw the kids bouncing around tonight. Just, they can hardly contain themselves. They want to run so bad. Talked to a little girl, and I could see by the way she was walking. She was kind of walking about 3 or 4 feet off the ground, you know. I said, it's hard not to run, isn't it? And she's like, yeah, it really is. She just has so much energy. But even kids, even young people grow weary and tired. And vigorous young men stumble badly. Yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. So God never gets weary, verse 28, but verse 29, he knows that we do. And the promise is made, the promise he's given to us is that if we wait on him, he will give us strength. He'll increase our power. He'll enable us to run the race. It's this famous passage, mount up with wings as eagles. What an inspiring passage. But the question is it inspiring enough to actually do it? Do what? Fly like an eagle? To the sea? No, I'm talking about what is told to us. Those who wait for the Lord, those who wait on the Lord, they're the ones who mount up with wings as eagles. They're the ones who run and don't grow weary. So you probably have this somewhere. You probably have this framed on your wall at home, or it's maybe highlighted in your Bible, or it's on a plaque on your desk or something. Those who wait upon the Lord will mount up with wings as eagles and run and not grow weary. But the question is not whether you've memorized it, whether you've hung it up or set it out. The question is, have you applied it? Are you living in this promise tonight? And I can help you to see very easily whether you're living in this promise tonight, because basically, has the world wiped you out? Has the world just wiped you out? It's Thursday night. Probably most of you came from work. Are your coworkers just, have they drained you of strength? Family and friends and situations, maybe in your neighborhood or wherever it might be, your in-laws, who knows? Have those difficult situations made you too weary to walk? Just like, man, I don't even want to get out of bed in the morning. It's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd rather just get under the covers or crawl into a corner in the fetal position. See, if you get to that point, or I should actually say when you get to that point, if you're at that point now, then you may have, they will mount up with wings as eagles memorized, but you don't have it applied. And I don't say that by way of condemnation. I say that by way of exhortation of, you know what? Waiting on the Lord and gaining new strength is as simple as waiting on the Lord. Okay, that's fine and dandy. I never really figured out what waiting on the Lord was. You know what it is? This is great because God's made this so simple. Waiting on the Lord is simply this. Find a quiet place somewhere. Have a seat. Talk to God. Get into God's presence. And here's the key. This is it. Wait. Wait. This is what waiting on the Lord is. It's getting into the presence of God and waiting. That's it. That's it. It's like when my motorcycle battery dies. And trust me, that battery has died a lot of times. I finally had to buy a new one after 8 years. And I would put it on the charger. And you know, I'd put it on the charger because I wanted to go for a ride. So I'd put it on the charger. All right, 2 minutes, that's enough. Put it on there. Start. 2 minutes gave me... And you know what? It turned out that I wasn't going to be able to ride that day. It wasn't until I left it on the charger all night that it would then start the bike. It had to wait. I had to wait. And waiting on the Lord to renew your strength, to, pardon the pun, recharge your batteries, is waiting. It's finding a time and a place to get into the presence of God and waiting. There's no quick fix. There's no microwave. There's no drive-through. There's no fast food. There's nothing like we apply to everything. There's no minute rice, Jiffy Pop, microwave popcorn. There's none of it. There's no substitute for just waiting on the Lord. Here's what the scripture says. Psalm 27, wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. Psalm 40, I waited patiently. Notice how wait and patience are always like together. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me, and he heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit, out of the miry clay. He set my feet upon the rock, making my footsteps firm. And what we just read, those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They'll mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. It's just wait. And I bet you're thinking, that sounds like a good idea. I'm going to try and schedule that in. I'm going to open up my day timer. And it looks like I got a half an hour between soccer practice and football practice for the kids. I got a half an hour there. I can wait on the Lord. Ooh, well, there's driving. And they want McDonald's, and that's not going to work. Okay, next Tuesday, it looks like I don't have any meetings. You know what? Let's do it now. If you need to move, move. If you need to go somewhere by yourself instead of sitting next to your friend or your spouse, do that. I'm going to ask the guy at the light switch to turn off most of the lights and just wait on the Lord. Get into God's presence. Get into God's presence. It doesn't take anything at all. Closing your eyes helps. And getting into God's presence. And waiting. You can get into God's presence as simply as saying, "Here I am, God. Here I am, God." And just waiting. If you want to be ministered to in the worship, let that happen. If you want to sing along, if that helps you to wait, to focus, but wait. Just wait on the Lord.